first paragraph.
Look at that. Amazing. Chaz Hashem. Okay, so please join us. If you're interested in either the morning program or the evening program, please join us. It's a really all-encompassing, quite a number of shiurim. The psukim describe a woman who becomes a sota. A sota is a woman whose husband suspects her of infidelity. He accuses her of being involved with a certain gentleman, and he warns her not to go besaser, not to go privately with this man. If, in fact, she is found privately with that man, the entire parsha of sota applies to her. One of the things that happened to this woman is that she's brought out in public in a very demeaning, very degrading way. The Gemara explains to us that part of the rationale is we want her to admit. It looks very suspicious. If her husband warned her not to go into private with this man, he brought away two edim and warned her publicly not to go privately with this man, and she did, it looks pretty suspicious. If she then violates that warning, it looks raglayim ledover, it looks most likely that she in fact did succumb, that she did the sin, and we do not want her to die. If she drinks the mayim ha-ma'arim, if she drinks the water that the Kohen mixes with the name of Hashem, and she in fact had an affair, her stomach bursts and she dies, therefore we try different things to make sure that she admits. One of the things that we do is we put her in a very compromising position. She has to walk outside in a very degrading manner. She's thoroughly embarrassed. Hopefully, the goal is to get her to admit. Rashi makes a very important observation, and that is the parsha of Nazir is put right next to the parsha of Sota. And Rashi is bothered by why is it that the Torah puts the parsha of Sota right next to the parsha of Nazir. And Rashi explains to us the reason. A Nazir is a man who separates himself from earthly pleasures. One of the things that he's to vow himself away from, to abstain from, is wine. And Rashi explains to us, Lama nismacha parshas Nazir leparsha Sota. And why is it that the parsha of a Nazir is close to the parsha Sota? Lo malacha to tell you, shekola roa Sota bikukula. Whoever sees a Sota in her embarrassed state, whoever sees this woman publicly being degraded, Yazir atzman minayayin, should make a vow, should become a Nazir, separate himself from wine, shumevi lidei niyuf, because wine causes you to come to these various situations. Says Rashi, why is it that Sota and Nazir are put together? Because if in fact you see this woman, if you're one of the public, you're one of the men who witnessed this event, you should make a vow, you should abstain from wine, you should become a Nazir. Why? Because wine is what brought her to that Avera. You should make a neder to abstain from wine, and you should become a Nazir. And that's how Rashi explains the Smichos Parshios, why the two issues are brought together. I'd like to ask what I consider an obvious question on this Rashi. And that is wine damaging, dangerous, or not? If wine is something that is very, very detrimental, if it's something that's dangerous, then regardless of whether you saw the sota or didn't, you should separate yourself from it. Elamai, wine can be used in moderation, it can be used appropriately, then why does that change just because you saw the sota? Again, what Rashi is telling us is, if you were one of the thousands in that crowd, then you should make a neder. You should make a vow separating yourself from wine. Why? Because that woman got into trouble because of wine. Therefore, you separate from wine. If wine is dangerous, let the Torah tell me, become a Nazir. If wine is not dangerous, then the fact that I saw this woman get into trouble because of wine, she got into trouble, I won't. Why does my relationship to wine change based on whether I saw her or didn't see her? Meaning to say, if I was sleeping that day and I didn't see the event, if I didn't live in that town, I don't have to make a neder, but all of a sudden if I saw her, then I have to make a neder. Either wine is dangerous or it's not. It doesn't seem to be relevant at all whether I saw this woman be kilkula, whether I saw this woman get messed up or not. Yet Rashi says it's directly dependent on that, and I'd like to see if we can understand a little bit better what Rashi is trying to tell us here. And to do that, I'd like to focus on something that's oftentimes misunderstood. There is a Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Tainis who says as follows: if there is tsoros on the Klai Yisrael, if there are decrees, if things are looking rather bleak and dangerous, Says the Rambam that there is a mitzvah saseh, there is a positive commandment, lizok lefnei Hashem, to cry out in front of Hashem, to gather together as a tzibur. And then he defines very clearly what the mitzvah is. He says, if in fact there are decrees against the Jewish people, if there are shoyim who are standing up against us, then we have to gather together in large gatherings, we have to pull out shofros, we have to decree fasts, we have to gather together in this way to do tshuva. And if we do that, that is a mitzvah asay, and Hashem will listen to us. He then says, however, if something is being decreed against the Klai Yisrael, and you do not cry out to Hashem, and you say this is just the minhag of the world, this is just the way of the world, it's the power of men, it's just the natural machinations of men, and then, says the Rambam, you are called going bederech achzorius. You're going in a manner of cruelty, and you cause yourself to remain in these ways, and because Hashem is bringing these things for you to do tshuva. And the Rambam uses one expression that I think is very difficult to understand, and that is that if you ignore the events of your time, the Rambam does not say you're not religious. If you attribute the events that are going on around you to natural happenstance, the Rambam doesn't say that you're not wise, that you're foolhardy. The Rambam says you're cruel. And the question is, why does the Rambam say that if men are making decrees against the Klai Yisrael, and you do not gather together to do tshuva, you do not gather together to cry out to Hashem, that you're being cruel? It doesn't sound cruel, it sounds irreligious, maybe foolish, not understanding who's running the world, not understanding why Hashem brings these things, but it doesn't sound to be cruel. And I'd like to share with you what I believe the Rambam means, and I think it'll help us understand this Rashi. There is a Gemara in Yevamos that is central to understanding our role in the world. Says the Gemara as follows, Amar Blaza Bar Avina, Ein Peronios Bo La'olam, misfortunes do not come to the world, Ela Bishvil Yisrael. If you hear about hurricanes, typhoons, if you hear about tsunamis, if you hear about earthquakes, know and understand there's one reason. They do not come to the world except for Yisrael. Says Rashi, what does that mean? Li yira'am, to cause them to fear, kedei sheyachzuru b'tshuva, in order for them to do tshuva. Meaning, it could be that the 1.2 million people who died in that earthquake were supposed to die anyway, but not that way. And the reason why Hashem brought that calamitous event was so that the Klai Yisrael should wake up and say, wow, that's how Hashem runs the world, and we should do tshuva. Or it could even be more extreme. It could even be that that event was not supposed to happen. Those people normally would not have died, but because the Klai Yisrael were not doing what they should have done, Hashem acted more b'midas ad-din, more strictly and more severely, and people ended up dying who should not have necessarily have died. In 1918, after World War I, when the war was over, between 18 and 20 million people died of something called the flu. 18 to 20 million people died, like that, worldwide. And what a Jew is supposed to look at and see is that is Hashem running the world. When a tragedy happens to a foreign country, somewhere that I've never heard of, deep in the African jungle, and a tribe is wiped out, I'm supposed to read the headlines of the paper and say, that is for Yisrael. Everything under the planet happens for Yisrael. It's the reason Hashem created the world. It's the reason Hashem runs the world. And when you hear about Peronius, when you hear about misfortunes, calamities, these events happening, says the Gemara, it's only for Yisrael. There's a story about the Chofetz Chaim that he once heard about an earthquake in Japan. And his Talmidim said he turned white and he began a fast. And they couldn't understand. First of all, there were no Jews in that entire region. And second of all, no one even heard of the place. And the Chofetz Chaim said, didn't you read this Gemara? It's a Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Samach Gimel, Amud Aleph, that says, no misfortune comes to the world except for the Jews. That means Hashem is sending us a message. If we get it, if we listen, if we open our ears, then it's good. And if not, then Hashem has to send other messengers, other ways to let us know. And I believe what the Rambam is saying is very, very clear. When you have a very cruel, evil man standing up against the Jewish nation, do not fear him. He is but a pawn. He's but a messenger. But you had better shake. You had better tremble. Because there's someone sending that message. And that someone is the creator of the heavens and the earth. And if you do not cry out to Hashem, if you do not do tshuva when you see that man rattling his saber, then you are cruel. Why? Because you're being cruel to yourself. Because what it means is Hashem is going to have to bring more decrees and worse situations until you finally wake up. Because if you don't listen to the far-off roll of the thunder, then Hashem has to bring it closer and closer, and eventually it has to be mamash b'charon af, because you didn't open your ears to hear. And says the Rambam, if you don't respond to what's going on in your times, if you don't wake up to hear the clarion call, you're an achzar, you're cruel. Who are you? Cruel to yourself. Because Hashem is running the world, Hashem is bringing you a message, and if you don't listen, it's going to be very, very rough and very, very difficult. And I believe that's exactly pshat in the Sota. You see, if you happen to have been there on the scene, it wasn't by happenstance, and it wasn't by coincidence. Hashem was sending you a message. That message is that Sota ruined her life because of wine. There's a message in that for you. If you weren't on the scene, you didn't necessarily have to stay away from wine. But if Hashem brought you that message, there's a message in it for you. You're the man who has to make a neder nezirus. Even though making an end of Naziris is not so simple. Even though you have to bring a carbon in the end, because it's not so 100% to be a Nazir. But there's a very important message that Hashem is delivering to you. You saw that, not by accident, not by happenstance. And if you're there, you have to react. If you don't know about it, if you weren't on the scene, if you weren't in that town, there's no need for you to react. But if it was in your town, your situation, within your purview, then you're obligated to react, because Hashem is sending you a message. And I believe that's exactly what Rashi is telling us, that if you see a sota b'kukula, you have to make a neder nezirus. In 1937, Neville Chamberlain became Prime Minister of Britain. Neville Chamberlain was a peace-loving man. Neville Chamberlain was a man who would wish for nothing other than the sun to shine, joy to be in all man's homes, and he was a man who loved peace. He was also a fool. Because in 1933, when Adolf Hitler came to power, Adolf Hitler made no bones about exactly his agenda. In the 20s, in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf. He spoke again and again exactly his intentions. And it was clear to anyone who had ears with which to listen, eyes with which to see, that Hitler was bent on world conquest. And yet Neville Chamberlain stood in front of the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and he told them, what we have to do is make peace. We have to bring peace. And he followed a very strict policy of appeasement. When Hitler demanded that Austria rejoin the German Reich, give it to him. That's all he wants. When Hitler demanded that Czechoslovakia become part of the Third Reich, give it to him. If we give him that, it'll be his last demand. And it's rather entertaining that when, in fact, Neville Chamberlain signed the Munich Agreement, giving over the Czech army to Hitler, eliminating one of the most powerful forces that could have stopped Germany, he came back to England with the following proclamation. My good friends, for the second time in our history, a British Prime Minister has returned from Germany bringing peace with honor. I believe it is peace for our time. Go home and get a nice, quiet sleep. The world did not get a nice, quiet sleep from that point on. But I'd like to share with you the irony of the times. World War I ended with the destruction of the German fighting force. The Treaty of Versailles, where the Allies guarantee that Germany would never rise again as a world power, Germany was seen as evil. Germany was accused of causing the First World War, which was correct. And the Allies were bent on one particular focus: never allow Germany again to rise. And the Treaty of Versailles almost guaranteed that. No industrial forces, tremendous reparations, and it was illegal for Germany to rearm. The standing army of Germany was limited to 100,000 men. They were allowed six ships at sea, no submarines, no air force. And in 1933, when Adolf Hitler came to power, Germany was a zero. As a fighting force, it was nothing. It had been dismembered, it was impotent. And had someone woken up in 33 or in 35 and read Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, had they listened to the speech after speech after speech, had they read even part of the Nuremberg Laws, had they understood what the man was saying and taken it at face value, Adolf Hitler would have been stopped in his infancy. There would never have been a Second World War. And there were a few people who were wise enough to recognize that. One of them was a gentleman named Winston Churchill. He was called the Lion That Roared because he stood up in the British Parliament and he screamed out, "Fools that you are! The man is saying what he means. Don't you understand?" And Neville Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister, hushed it up, went about his policy of appeasement, and the world suffered through what became the worst atrocity till that point in history because of foolishness, because not listening to what was clearly being said time after time. In 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran emerged. Iran, till that point, had been a democracy. It then became a theocracy. The ruling power in Iran, as you understand, is the Quran, is the Ayatollah. It is a theocracy. It is a government run by religion. From the moment of that declaration in 1979, it became a terrorist state. On November 4th, 1979, as you probably remember, the Iranian students seized the U.S. embassy and held it for 444 days. Since 1985, which was the first time that the State Department began issuing reports about this issue, Iran has been designated a terrorist state. And it has been deemed the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, year after year. You know, it's almost like a rating system. Who's up there? Is it Iraq? Is it Iran? Is it Saudi Arabia? Iran has won the tournament, won the contest year after year for the leading state sponsor of terrorism. According to the State Department's report on terrorism for 2006, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards and Ministry of Intelligence are directly involved in planning and support of terrorism acts, which include supporting Hezbollah, including helping Al-Qaeda support insurgencies in Iraq, including such things that are directly linked to Iran as airplane hijacking, killing U.S. soldiers, kidnapping of American Europeans, restaurant bombings in Spain. But the biggest chiddush is that Hezbollah is funded and was created in Iran. It had its beginning in 1982 in Iran. It was an offshoot of the military arm of the Iranian soldiers, and it's supported to this day. It's very ironic to hear about Nasrallah bragging about the fact that he could shoot 1,000 to 3,000 rockets a day into Israel, and every penny is funded to him by Iran. He meets regularly with the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, to bolster their relationship. I'd like to share with you one interesting fact. The only way that Palestinians get money these days, one of the best ways, is to have a family member blow themselves up. The family becomes wealthy. Would you like to know where the funding comes from? A pipeline directly from Iran. As a matter of fact, it's been reported by a number of people. Mohammad Zohar was one of the founders of Hamas. He told the German newspaper Der Spiegel on June 22nd that he transferred large sums of money from Iran. And listen to his words. "I personally once brought $20 million from Iran to the Gaza Strip in a suitcase." No. Actually, twice. The second time, it was $22 million. Money is being directly funded from Iran into Gaza to the various terrorist groups, to support whatever is going on there. And if you wonder where those rockets are coming from, don't wonder so much. So here's a little question I have. Does Iran really mean what they say? I mean, you know, are they really a terrorist group or not? So let's sort of ask ourselves what they say, and let's take at face value for a moment their words. I'd like to quote for you the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei. This is in Associated Press on October 29, 2008. "The hatred of the Iranian nation for America is deep-seated. The reason is the various conspiracies by the U.S. government against the Iranian people and government in the past 50 years. He is the real power that be. The Zionist regime and the American government are the main enemies of Iran, and the hatred for America is deepening every day around the globe." Here's a little quote from a gentleman you may have heard of in the news lately, a gentleman, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. I try not to scratch my throat too much when I pronounce his name. "America should understand the message from the people of the region. It's manifest in a single slogan, death to America. Death to America." He doesn't say that in the broadcast that are sent to the Western world, but that is broadcast on the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran radio, October 20, 2006. "We have advised the Europeans and Americans who are far away that you are neighbors of nations in this region. We inform you that the nations are like an ocean that is welling up. And if a storm begins, the dimensions will not stay limited to Palestine. You may get hurt. It is in your own interest to distance yourself from these criminals, Israel. This is an ultimatum." Now, that they reject Israel's right to exist and that they threaten Israel on a regular basis is obvious. But you have to hear when the man threatens on a regular basis, not Israel, but America. And he threatens in very, very clear terms. And as a matter of fact, I'd like to share with you something that you may not know. The Iranian president, democratically elected, I may say, made the following statement. "The president of America is like us. That is, he too is inspired, but his inspiration is of the satanic kind. Satan gives inspiration to the president of America." Okay, now I'll grant you that was for the last president, the Satan. But to say words like that, I've been asked, do I have a connection with God? And the answer is I do. Since God said that the infidels will have no way to harm the believers, only if we are believers because God said, you will be the victors. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that in the Iranian news agency on October 14th, 2006. "We are proud of supporting Hezbollah since they are defending their homeland, and you are wrong in calling them terrorists," said the Iranian parliament speaker and former nuclear negotiator Ali Larijani. Now, if you would like to know what the focus of the Iranian government is right now, it's also been pretty clear. If the United States and the international community want Iran to give up the know-how it has regarding the nuclear program, they are talking nonsense. In whatever negotiation we take part, it is unequivocally with the view of the realization of Iran's nuclear right, and the Iranian nation would not retreat one iota from its right, also said by Ahmadinejad on October 2, 2008. "And the current situation of the Security Council is devoid of legitimacy, and its decisions prohibiting Iran from enriching uranium are devoid of legitimacy." Once again, our buddy Ahmadinejad. "The Iranian people, because of its past culture and its past civilization, its intelligent youth, its human and material potential, has the capacity to quickly become an invincible global power. This will happen as soon as it achieves advanced technologies." One more time, our buddy Ahmadinejad. September 28th, 2006, I wonder what he means when he says advanced technologies. It is now a reported fact that Iran is about 1 year away from nuclear capacity. It was reported by Time magazine. It was reported by Fox News. It really was based on reports to the State Department that had come out much earlier and much stronger. But it's pretty much accepted now that Iran is capable of producing a nuclear bomb within a year's time. Now, what do you say to that? Does that scare you? You may say, well, listen, granted, Iran may develop a nuclear weapon, but there's no way in the world they're going to use it, neither on Israel nor on America, because there are going to be reprisals that will devastate that part of the region. They'll wipe them off the face of the planet. Now, for the record, I'm not 100% sure that a real believer is afraid of that, because, after all, you buy heaven with different currencies. And if, in fact, it means wiping out a civilization, that's the way you buy your portion in heaven. Certainly, if you listen to the clerics in the Muslim world, that's not so strange. But let's even grant that there are people who are running the government in Iran who are bright enough to recognize the fact that Israel has enough nuclear force to absolutely obliterate them. The United States of America would wipe them off the map. So let's grant the fact that Iran would never be dumb enough to directly attack Israel or America. But what about just happening to slip a few missiles into the hand of, say, Islamic Jihad or Hamas or maybe Hezbollah, and nothing to do with Iran, just some wild radicals shot this little nuclear warhead? We apologize profusely. We don't know how it escaped our undercover, got out of our country. We don't even know where it came from, but of course it wasn't us. And if you believe that is remote, I believe that you are naive, because it is 100% within the belief of doctrine of that government. It's something they speak about, if not overtly, if not openly, certainly between the lines, and it's without a doubt something that they are pursuing very radically and very, very strongly. Now, if you're not scared and this doesn't frighten you, I would like to offer you something to read. There is a book, a very short book, and it won't take you long to read. The book has a simple title. The title of the book is Hiroshima, written by a gentleman called John Hersey. The book details the life of six survivors of Hiroshima. And the book describes what these six people went through when the city of Hiroshima was obliterated. And it describes August 6, 1945 at 6 a.m. Each one of them were going about a normal day. One was sleeping. One was up early to go to work. One was looking out on the veranda. And that's how 6 a.m. passed, very pleasantly. And it was a regular, ordinary day until 8:15 a.m. when their world changed. And every one of them described this brilliant flash, this sheet of sun just coming right across the sky. You see, the six survivors were survivors because they were nowhere near the epicenter. If you were within 1 mile radius of the epicenter, you were toast. When I say toast, millions of degrees hot was the explosion. It then spread out a fireball that consumed everything within the first mile radius. The explosion wasn't a sound. There was no loud boom. It's just that if you were within 2 to 3 miles away from the epicenter, the buildings just collapsed. They just fell to the ground. And no one could figure it out because it wasn't even a sound. Just the force of the expanding air was so great that everything just collapsed. And these survivors describe what it was like looking at some of the people who were closer to the epicenter as they walked out, burnt. If you were really close to the epicenter, there were some interesting remains. They describe a wall where you saw the outline of a man. You see, at the center where the bomb drops, there's such intense heat that you're not burnt to death, you vaporize. Literally, the liquid inside the body, the cells, become vapor, and you saw a shadow of the man on the wall because everything from inside of him burst out, and what was left was the image of the man. And that was the first mile radius. And if you were further away, then it was just the intense heat that seared, that burnt anything there, anything combustible. Minutes. Explain to you later. Just remember that, 33 minutes. Anything combustible, anything that could have melted, melted. And the survivors described seeing streams of people walking out, charred, faces burnt. And they described an entire group of people saying, "I can't see, I can't see, I can't see anything." And the survivors described when they looked at the faces, they saw water dripping out from the eyes because their eyeballs had melted, because the extreme heat had seared everything there. A woman was wearing a flower dress. Burnt into her body was the flowers because the heat was absorbed by the black but not by the white. So into her body was burnt the flowers, which were black, but not the rest of a kimono, which was white. And 100,000 people died almost instantly. The rest of the population suffered tremendous amounts of radiation, suffered for years afterwards. An entire city was obliterated, wiped off the face of the planet. That was a primitive, low-grade atomic weapon. That is not what we're discussing now. When we're discussing Iran's nuclear capability, it's a different generation. The power, the magnitude, the force is of a totally different sort. And if this doesn't scare you, I just want you to imagine for a minute what it would be like, Rahman al-Tzan, and I shouldn't even say the words, but Laman Hashem, I will say the words. What if it were Yerushalayim? What if it were Tel Aviv? What if it were Haifa that was the epicenter? And it wasn't 100,000 Jews, but it was far greater than that. If for 2 to 3 kilometers, maybe 3 miles, everything was burnt to an absolute crisp. And if you feel secure, because listen, Baruch Hashem, I don't live in Israel where it's dangerous. I live in a safe place like New York. If you heard the beeping at 33 minutes, that is the time it takes for a missile to be launched from Iran to the center of any city in the United States of America. 33 minutes from launch till detonation. And if you think Iran is too close, the Gaza's not much further away. It's but another couple of minutes. 33 minutes from launch till the obliteration of an entire civilization, certainly a city. But life as we know it radically changed forever. Because you see, it's not one little pop. It's one little explosion, and then one little retaliation, and one more, and one more, and one more. And life as we know it changes in a very, very radical way. Of course, you and I both know that this can never happen. Never. It just can't be. And you know why it can't be? Because I wish that it won't be. President Reagan, a very wise man, said, "It is up to us to choose wisely or blindly hope for the best while the enemies of freedom grow stronger every day." He said that in 1983. Well, my friends, 8 years ago, war was declared on democracy. This country was attacked. War was declared upon it. And our enemies don't forget it for a minute. The only ones who forget that we're at war are the citizens of the United States of America, the European Union, and everyone in Western civilization forgets that we have an enemy that has declared war against us, that has never rescinded that challenge, that stands to destroy every vestige of freedom, every vestige of Western civilization, and wishes to conquer totally and annihilate anything that they consider infidels. And if you're not quite sure that I'm correct, listen very carefully to what they say again and again, over and over, as clearly as they can. And what's very interesting is the fact that there's a president of the United States of America, the country upon whom war was declared, who is now seeking in the most powerful manner imaginable to negotiate peace with the president of this theocracy, who, as you know, was again duly democratically just reelected in an uncontested fair election. And amazingly, the president of the United States of America recognizes this man as a partner in peace, a partner in freedom, and wishes to negotiate with this man. And here are the two questions I'd like to ask you. Question number one, how can a sane, rational man give up the safety of his country for something so illusionary, something so ludicrous, and something so silly? And I'd like to offer you that there's only one way that such a thing can happen. And that is that people living in our civilization, living in our culture, judge people in other civilizations, in other cultures, by the same standards as we have. So therefore, all you have to do is give them a little bit of understanding, give them a little bit of lateral movement, give them a chance to express themselves, and they'll be peace-loving just as we are, because all men are the same. All civilizations are the same. All peoples wish for the same thing. The only thing that's interesting is that history does not quite agree with that theme. You see, if you go back to the Catholic Church of, say, 1,000 years ago, and if you start noting the war-hungry, killing, murderous crusades that they launched, and now if you go back to the First Crusade or the Second Crusade or the Third Crusade, and you hear the word infidel, and you know that this was a sweeping attempt by the Pope to clear the path to Palestine, to take back Palestine from the infidels. And why bother waiting till we destroy the infidel there, kill every infidel along the way, whether he's Jewish or Jewish or Jewish or Jewish? And it's okay if he's Jewish. We'll just kill him. And if you hear the words that the church spoke for hundreds of years, for over 1,000 years, you hear a bloodthirsty cry of absolute barbarism and destructive force. Right now, it's a very different religion. Right now, Western culture has changed. Even the church now no longer begs for the death of infidels, no longer demands the death of Jews. Even the church speaks very differently right now. But gentlemen, I'd like to share with you that the Islamic world has not changed in 14 centuries. For 1,400 years, they have remained steadfast in their belief. And that is that the Muslim world must remain supreme, and there is a war of civilizations, a war of the Islamic world against the infidels. And if you wish to understand that culture, if you wish to understand that way of life, just study the church of the Middle Ages, study the proclamations of the popes, study the barbarism and the bloodletting that they engaged in generation after generation, and no one understands that the Muslim world is back in that era. They have not changed. They didn't become reformed. They didn't become enlightened. They're back there. And if you'd like to understand how people can believe and just give them a little bit of latitude, negotiate peace, it's because they're falling under this mistake of judging different civilizations by their own code, and it doesn't match. And that's the answer to how liberals in this land, and I dare say, again, we have an obligation to respect the president, but I dare say that it sure does seem that he's embarking on such a path. And I believe that that's how we can understand how intelligent, bright people can sell their nation. Forget Israel. Sell American safety. 33 minutes is not the time it takes to launch from Gaza to Tel Aviv. It's from Iran to Washington. And if you wonder how the present government can sell away the most basic demand of government, which is the defense of its own people, it's because they fall under this illusionary guise that the Islamic world is just like us. They're willing and interested in peace. But I have a separate question to ask you. How did this man rise to power? The average American is not a fool. The average American believes in red, white, and blue. The average American will go to fight for his country. The average American will stand up for democracy, fight for freedom, and knows and understands that this is fallacious. How did this man come to power in our time? And I'd like to share with you a very simple observation. It's my 401k, your retirement plan. It's my invested interest in my wealth. You see, we, Western civilization, have become so enamored with the almighty dollar that we've been duped. My goodness, my stock portfolio is now worth 25% of what it had been. I'm a quarter of the man that I used to be. My 401k is bupkis, there's nothing left. And we've become so duped, so transfixed by this thing called money, that when the market crashed, nobody cared about anything else but change, because change means hopefully the economy will change. Enough of this stuff in Iraq. Enough of hearing about banks being potentially bankrupt. We need change. And if you wonder how it is that this has happened, I believe that this is one of the mofsim that Hashem has arranged. A sudden, strange, inexplicable economic crisis. All of a sudden, out of the blue, the world economy takes a dive. Such a powerful dive, hits a whirlpool down that no one can understand, no one can explain. It was rising and rising and rising, and just at the right moment, it crashes. Just when there's an election, just when the right person is going to talk about economic stimulus and change and a new way and a new world, and suddenly we find ourselves in a very, very interesting situation, being led by a leader who has a very, very strange perception of the dangers out there. You have my assurances, if Ronald Reagan were president today, there would not be discussions with Iran about their ability to remain nuclear. There would be discussions about Iran's ability to remain. If the first President Bush were president, it would be mighty different. And if the second President Bush were in power, it would also be mighty different. But the reality is that there's a very different mindset in Washington. And gentlemen, it's not by accident. It's not by happenstance. It's not because Hashem wasn't watching the ship. It's by design, brought, hand-delivered, with a very strange scenario, a sudden market collapse, a sudden intractable war in Iraq. The climate is ripe for no one, for a man without any real military knowledge, certainly without any great knowledge of diplomacy, certainly without any knowledge of foreign policy, a rank junior to become the commander-in-chief of the United States of America, put into the position of power at the key central moment in history when there is a terrorist regime that is on the verge of nuclear conquest. Rather intriguing, isn't it? And if you'd like to know the punchline is really quite simple. That's exactly what the Rambam's saying. Don't misread the headlines. It's not about Nasrallah. It's not about Ahmadinejad. It's about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What Hashem is doing is rattling the sabers. Hashem is beating the wars of drums so that we should understand. The drums of war are beating so that we should wake up, we should hear them, and we should get it. And I have to share with you, for the first time in my adult life, I am afraid. You see, I always sincerely believed that we were right at the point of Mashiach coming, and I assumed that all of the descriptions of the Nevi'im, all of the tortures, everything that's described as the wars of Gog and Magog, were filled quite full in share in World War II. And my assumption was that the next step is going to be beautiful. Sun rising stronger and stronger, Eretz Yisrael becoming stronger, the Jewish nation repopulating it, Torah flourishing, and Mashiach coming with one beautiful, peaceful moment. And I dare say, for the first time in my adult life, I'm not so sure that that's the next step. I know that Mashiach is imminent, but I don't know whether the next step is peaceful or the next step is catastrophic. And if you hear what's going on out there, if you read the headlines of the papers, if you listen to the man's threats, and it's not a single man, do you know that Malcolm Hoenlein, who is a very wise, intelligent man, said he'd much rather have Ahmadinejad in office? Because if you know who he's running against, you know that Ahmadinejad is considered a moderate. It is a theocracy. The others are not exactly liberal Democrats. And if you understand they are on the verge of nuclear weaponry, and you understand that the damage can be inflicted with one launch, and 33 minutes from the launch, the world that we came to know ends, you understand that there's what to think about and what to pay attention to. I believe it is rather clear, the message. It's exactly what the Rambam says. The choice is ours. I promise you, the governments of the world, the United Nations, does not determine the future of the world. Ein paronius ba ela bishvil Yisrael. The Gemara is telling us the centrality of the Jewish people in world history, in world events. It's us, gentlemen. Hashem created the world for the Klal Yisrael. Hashem created the Klal Yisrael to learn Torah. The reason we're in existence is to serve Hashem. And if you'd like to understand the center point of all of world history, it's us and it's our reaction. You may say, I'm not a world statesman. I'm not called upon to vote on whether to attack Iran or not. That may be correct, but it's you and I who are going to daven Shemoneh Esrei. It's you and I who are going to turn to our Creator. It's you and I who are going to understand how Hashem runs the world and learn to listen to the messages. Rashi is telling us a tremendous yesod. If you are by a sota, there's an obligation upon you to learn from the scene. Why did Hashem bring you to that scene? Why did you see the sota b'kukula? Not by accident, but to teach you a lesson. If you've seen it, you have to be nozir atzmo min hayayin. You have to hear the message. What the Rambam is telling us is much bigger. And that is, if there are war drums beating, then there's a message that Hashem is sending. If there are tzoros against the Klal Yisrael, there are people who are threatening, there's a very clear message. And if you don't respond properly, you're an achzar, you're cruel. Why are you cruel? Because you are the one who's bringing it. It's smoke, it's mirrors, it's a mirage. They can't touch us. They can't even begin to think about touching a Jew unless we allow them. Hashem created the world, Hashem runs the world, and is one thing that Hashem wants, and that's for the Klal Yisrael to serve Him. And if we get it, if we hear the message, if we're chozer b'tshuva, if we really wake up, then we're invincible, we're exalted, we're the mighty chosen nation. No one on the planet can touch us. But if we don't respond appropriately, then we're achzorim, we are cruel, because we are the ones who are bringing that to happen. Neville Chamberlain was a fool when he said the word sleep. When he said the words, go home and sleep, a quiet sleep, he was a blathering fool. And he brought the world to tremendous, tremendous torture. There are those out there today who have the same attitude of appeasement, who don't listen to the words of our enemies and take them at face value. As Neville Chamberlain didn't listen to the words of Adolf Hitler, there are people now who do not listen to the words that are spoken again and again. Clearly, they live in their world of delusion. But I'd like to close with one last thought. How many people died in World War II? How many people? So if you ask anybody you know, the answer is 6 million people, right? 6 million Jews died in World War II. Now that is correct. About 6 million Jews died in World War II. But that's not how many people died in World War II. No, 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 no. You see, there were quite a number of other people who died. The United States of America had very light between the casualties. They only had about between 500,000 and 1 million people who either died or were wounded severely. Britain suffered far more. Russia suffered between 2 million and 6 million. If you deal with all the civilian casualties, the amount that died because of disease, because of famine, direct consequences of war, they estimate between 50 and 70 million people died during the war years. 50 to 70 million people. And it was something that could have been averted. In 1933, Hitler was a puppet. Do you know when he came to power, he laid a plan in front of his generals for the war. And they made very clear plans what they needed. How many planes, how many tanks, how many U-boats. And in 1939, after 6 years of intense rearmament, being allowed to the absolute max, he decided to declare war. And his attempt to declare war was to pull Neville Chamberlain into a trap. He knew that no fool would allow him to take over Czechoslovakia. No one in their sane mind would allow that to happen because the Czechoslovakian Republic had a powerful army. That army alone would have been a tremendous obstacle to stop Hitler. And Hitler called Chamberlain's bluff. And amazingly, Chamberlain gave in and allowed him to do it. And according to reports in the German Reich, Hitler was heard saying the words, "He spoiled. That fellow spoiled my entry." Hitler wanted that to be the declaration of war. He saw it as a grand opportunity, and Neville, the idiot, gave him everything on a silver platter. At that point in 1939, Hitler was 25% ready for war. His generals did not want to go to war because they knew that they were nowhere near prepared. But had they been stopped, not after 6 years of rearmament, had they been stopped in 1935, 36, or 37, there never would have been a World War II. It would have been a quick battle, destroy a couple of armies, and it's over. 50 to 70 million people would not have died. And my friends, we are standing in a very, very important juncture in history, because what we're discussing now is not 50 or 70 million people. When you're talking about a nuclear war, I don't know the numbers. I know that there are currently 6.5 billion occupants of the planet. I do not even know how to imagine what it's like when you destroy a city like Los Angeles, like Boston, like New York. I don't even know how to start counting the counter casualties when the United States of America launches its reparations and then attacks the regions that began the war. But the numbers are astronomical and frightening, and Rebosai, it's something that can be changed. The leaders of the democratic world have to wake up and at least believe in their minds that it's in their power. That's certainly the Derech HaTeva. That's certainly the ways of intelligent government. But it's upon us a much greater obligation, and that's to wake up and understand what Hashem is trying to teach us, what's really going on, what the great secret is, and that is Hashem is giving us a message. And at the end of the days, it's not in Washington, it's not in the United Nations, it's in our hands. And Kodesh Baruch Hu grant us that the Mashiach come in a very, very powerful, positive way, without the bloodshed, without the torture, and here be Aminu.